B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, January 19th, 2017, the last full day of the Obama administration. And you know what comes next. This podcast is available every day on YouTube, just another way to catch the Peter B. Collins podcast. So I am invigorated to see that people are really turning to public protest in view of the impending inauguration of Donald Trump and his wrecking crew in Washington, D.C. And all across the country, including in my lily-white rich community here, Marin County, California, people are taking to the streets on Inauguration Day, on the day after for the Women's March, and there's an anti-abortion march that has been held annually. It's going to be occurring in San Francisco, in Washington, many other places. And I support the First Amendment right of people to engage in peaceful freedom of speech protest of our governments, local, state, federal. And I believe in the robust rights that are enshrined in the First Amendment. But there are Republican legislators across the country in six states who are introducing bills that would enable law enforcement to, for example, in Indiana, remove any protesters who are blocking traffic by any means necessary. This seems to indemnify law enforcement officials who might shoot or kill an unarmed First Amendment activist who happens to be blocking a street. And that, of course, is Mike Pence's state. He is Trump's vice president, who will be sworn in tomorrow. And the law reads that officials like a mayor or a county sheriff have 15 minutes after learning of a mass traffic obstruction in their jurisdiction to dispatch all available law enforcement officers with directions to use any means necessary. Now, you might find that offensive and troubling, and when you think about how it could be used, it's pretty frightening, and it's unconstitutional. But in North Dakota last week, the site of the Standing Rock protests, Republicans introduced a bill that would allow motorists to run over and kill any protester obstructing a highway as long as they can claim it was done accidentally. By the way, I saw a live Facebook feed from Standing Rock last night, and protesters are continuing to confront the law enforcement officials who have re-barricaded the bridge that the protesters have tried to keep open for greater access to their encampment and for access to medical facilities if they are needed. In Minnesota, a bill introduced by Republicans last week seeks to dramatically stiffen fines for freeway protests and would allow prosecutors to seek a full year of jail time for protesters blocking a highway. In Washington state, Republicans have proposed a plan to reclassify as a felony civil disobedience protests that are deemed economic terrorism. And who defines that? Whose economic losses are greater than your right to free speech and protest? In Michigan, guess who? Republicans introduced and then shelved a month ago an anti-picketing law that would increase penalties against protesters and make it easier for businesses to sue individual protesters for their actions. And in Iowa, you guessed it, a Republican lawmaker has pledged to introduce legislation to crack down on highway protests. This is the leading edge of fascism, friends. This is something where Trump will be able to point to an outbreak here, a disturbance there. And this weekend could be critical. It could provide the fodder. Across the bay from me, Oakland is an active place for protesters. And unfortunately, protests there in the city center, at Jack London, at the Civic Center, Frank Ogawa Plaza, it's called. It was once called Occupy Plaza. Protesters there often attract a kind of a black bloc element that engages in vandalism and other, you know, crimes that cause economic disruption. And if the protests this weekend, and by the way, James O'Keefe is out there with Project Veritas. I've been hearing Sean Hannity screaming about this all week. He's got another selectively edited video of protesters who claim that they're going to conduct some serious violence in Washington during and after the inauguration tomorrow. Now, I'm not in the business of predicting these kinds of events. But as I look at this, I think it's highly likely that some of these protests will turn violent. And then this will be used by Trump to say, I told you I would stop the violence. He's got Obama's NDAA that allows them to lock up at a military base without charge or trial anybody who's suspected of terrorism. And if you call it economic terrorism or domestic terrorism, political terrorism, these are untested standards. And so we are entering a very dark era. And the way Trump has pandered to the pro-police elements in our politics is frightening when you see, for example, this important new investigative piece from BuzzFeed. And I give BuzzFeed credit. They've taken a lot of heat for releasing the so-called Oppo Research dossier on Trump. They recently hired the FOIA king, Jason Leopold, who just wrote his first piece for BuzzFeed a couple of days ago. And let me single out for praise Albert Samaha, the reporter, who wrote a lengthy investigative piece. I have linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. BuzzFeed reviewed 62 incidents of video footage where the video directly contradicted the officer's version of events in a police report or courtroom testimony. 62 incidents. And let's just cut right to the bottom line. Because out of those 62 cases that were reviewed, only 22 led to charges being filed against an officer, and only 9 of those resulted in convictions. And the opening anecdote in the BuzzFeed article here is right in my backyard in San Francisco, where in a case that was dismissed by federal judge Charles Breyer, Officer Nicholas Buckley wrote up a report that he swore was accurate. He testified based on that report in an open courtroom. And the version of events that he gave was directly contradicted by a surveillance video that he didn't know existed. And the defense attorneys trotted out that video, prompting Breyer to dismiss the case. And Officer Buckley is one of those who has not only not been convicted, he hasn't even been indicted. And 8 months after the incident, he remains on the San Francisco police force. Now, this article includes access for you to video footage that you can see. So take a look at a case that occurred near you or that you have some familiarity with. This is a very serious problem. And if protesters are subject to these new state laws, this will empower law enforcement to concoct crimes, to frame people, manipulate the video cameras, the body cams that many of them are now wearing. But gosh, did I remember to turn it on? And so while many other news and comment outlets today are focused on the trivia of Obama transitioning to Trump and speculation about what's going to happen, I draw your attention to this very serious assault on our most cherished fundamental rights enshrined in the first 10 amendments. That's why we call them the Bill of Rights. It is my contract with my government. And these right-wing fascists are intent on changing the terms of that contract unilaterally. And so I support peaceful protest. And I will be engaging in events over the next few days right here in California. And if you are so moved, I encourage you to do the same. Well, as if Obama needed one more drone strike and one more military assault to round out his second term in office, we've learned that he ordered 2 B-2 stealth bombers to fly all the way from Missouri to Libya to drop more than 100 bombs on the Libyan seaside town of Sirte, where the Islamic State had been established. We're told they were routed months ago. And apparently we got intelligence that they're back, so Obama approved this operation. And just for fun, he also sent some MQ-9 armed drones. Now, that is a model I haven't heard about. I've heard about the Reaper and the Raptor and a bunch of other ones. But this is described as an armed drone that has Hellfire missiles on it. And while we don't know what happened on the ground, who got killed and whether any innocents were struck, we're told, well, it's a remote desert location. We don't believe any civilians were hit in the bombardment. But of course, we say that all the time. And Obama has been the king of drones. One of many failures of his administration that's not acknowledged by the blind Democratic boosters of what I call the Obama cult. New York Times editorial board begging Obama in a last-ditch effort, praising him first. He did the right thing in granting clemency to Chelsea Manning. But hey, how about Ed Snowden? And I think they make a good case for clemency for Ed Snowden. But I think Obama's really dug in on that one, and I don't expect any shift. Also, the Times praised him, and I wanted to mention and forgot yesterday, that Obama showed courage in giving a commutation to Oscar Lopez Rivera, a member of the FALN, the Puerto Rican Liberation Group. And he has been in prison for, a long time. His sentence was 70 years. And he has had his sentence commuted. And to its credit, the Times mentions a name that I've been mentioning frequently, Leonard Peltier, the Native American convicted of killing two FBI agents at the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota back in 1975. And what about Don Siegelman? His supporters email frequently, and I encourage you to call the White House if you want to make a last gasp request for relief for Don Siegelman. And speaking of Snowden, the Russian government has extended his asylum until 2020. Now, it's unclear if Donald Trump has any axe to grind about Snowden, but the generals and conservatives that he has surrounded himself have it in for Snowden. So I think this is good insurance. And by the way, once he's been there 5 years, which will occur, I think, sometime late next year, Ed Snowden qualifies to apply for Russian citizenship. I also mentioned Don Siegelman and the reporter who has been dogged and brought us some of the best coverage of the Siegelman saga is Roger Shuler. And I want to recommend that you visit his blog. I've linked to his latest post at the Legal Schnauzer blog. And before I get into that, the Shulers are once again living on the edge. They could really use your financial support. There is a PayPal donate button on the homepage at Legal Schnauzer, and if you have the means to help them, I truly hope that you will. And Roger Shuler's been very courageous recently in his reporting about Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, Trump's nominee to head the Justice Department. It's a very bad pick, and Shuler has been courageous in asserting that Jeff Sessions is a closeted gay man. You can read all about it at the Legal Schnauzer blog. Now, today's post, he takes on a little old publishing company called the Hearst Corporation. And what's fascinating is that when Roger Shuler was railroaded into the jail there in Alabama behind false charges of libel and defamation, that was covered in a bizarre way by the Hearst female-oriented glam publication called Marie Claire. And Marie Claire took the side of Jessica Medeiros Garrison, who Shuler had accused of having an affair with her boss, the Attorney General Luther Strange in Alabama. And I have supported Roger in his reporting all along. I have great confidence in his work. And he is now suing the Hearst Corporation, Yellowhammer News, and alalabama.com. They ran essentially the same story almost verbatim, and it included provable falsehoods. Now, get this. Of course, they claimed that Garrison was the winner in a trial against Shuler and was awarded $3.5 million. Problem is, there never was a trial. There was a hearing, and Roger Shuler was not invited to attend. So he's clearly got them on the ropes with a false statement. But the Hearst Corporation's lawyers claim that there was a trial and that the statement is substantially true and not capable of a defamatory meaning. And I encourage you to read Roger's post and the arguments that he raises, because it shows gross inconsistencies in dealing with the issues of his case and the false reporting that it produced. Another failure of President Obama, of course, is in the area of torture. To his credit, he decreed, and then Congress buttressed that with some legal maneuvers, that torture would not occur in his administration. And for the most part, except for the treatment of Chelsea Manning, we can believe that that may be true. But here on his final day of office, we are learning through documents that have surfaced through the court case in Spokane, Washington, the case against the contractors who were hired by the CIA to devise the torture program and consult on individual torture sessions. And we're learning quite a bit. In the New York Times, they talk about a document, a cable from August 5th, 2002, a newly disclosed document about the torture program and the details of the torture methods applied to Abu Zubaydah. And we know that Abu Zubaydah was not the guy they thought he was. He should have been released a long time ago, but he will languish indefinitely at Guantanamo. But to its credit, the Times reports on Abu Zubaydah's accounts of the torture that was applied and contrasts it with the kind of clinical and limited language that's used in the cables and emails reporting on it. And as I mentioned, this surfaces out of the lawsuit against the people suspected of masterminding all this, and that is Bruce Jessen and Jim Mitchell. Now, the cables also disclosed that there was a lot of dispute and feuding inside the CIA about the hiring of these two characters. And we also learn that the CIA, in this document, admits using drugs on people for the intent of disorienting them. And we know that everyone who arrived at Guantanamo was dosed up with an anti-malaria drug, even though there was no malaria at Guantanamo. And it had psychotic side effects. It's called mefloquone. I'm adding that. That was not confirmed in this report today, but the use of pharmaceuticals was. And the Washington Post, in a parallel report, explains the dissension inside the ranks at the CIA. Said these guys have shown blatant disregard for the ethics shared by almost all of their colleagues. And one unnamed officer wrote, if some untoward outcome is later to be explained, their sole use in this role will be indefensible. Well, it is indefensible, and Obama should have pursued that, and he chose not to. And now we have the new CIA director who says, well, I will not accept an order to torture if it comes from Donald Trump, and I wouldn't expect it would happen. The other element that is raised here in the Post story is about the disputes and the debate inside the professional ranks of psychologists, saying that people like Jessen and Mitchell should not be participating in torture sessions and advising on how to make it hurt more. And so these are very critical issues. And for this to surface on the last day of the Obama presidency, I think is fitting. Sadly so. Yesterday in Virginia, they snuffed a prisoner, a state-sponsored killing that we call execution. Their first execution in more than a year took 48 minutes. We don't know what kinds of drugs were used because the state is now permitted to secretly order and purchase deadly drugs for the purpose of state-sponsored killing. So the guy here, Ricky Gray, convicted of murdering a Richmond family of four back in 2006, he lay on the table snoring and breathing heavily as the corrections officials drew a curtain for more than 30 minutes until they pronounced him dead on the gurney. This is another grisly example of how our government and our system works, and it's really sad to see. In Israel, in the southern part, the Negev Desert, they have been rousting Arab citizens of the State of Israel, claiming that they needed to demolish their homes because they didn't have the proper permits. And, of course, Israel will not allow Arab citizens to get those permits, so it is a catch-22. 11 homes have been destroyed, and there was an incident where we are told in the official count, and this is from the Associated Press, which takes the government's version at face value and then reports the conflicting accounts. It reads this way. An Israeli Arab rammed his vehicle into a group of police officers Wednesday, killing one of them before he was shot dead during clashes in southern Israel. Local residents, though, said that the driver was trying to leave town and only lost control of his vehicle after police shot at him. His brother said he was murdered in cold blood. But, of course, the corporate media in this country, while acknowledging the conflicting accounts, leads with the official Israeli story, and they should be much more skeptical of the Israeli assertions. You know, we've heard that Donald Trump believes that climate change is a hoax and that China engineered the hoax. Well, here's contradicting evidence, and it's comforting to see that it appears the Chinese government is serious about reducing its carbon emissions in view of climate change. And the government has announced that they are canceling plans to build 103 coal-fired power plants. That's the best way to say it. That were planned to be constructed between now and 2020. So I think this is an important step forward, and we often have seen China as lagging and that has been costly to the United States. But this shows that they are taking it seriously. And finally, here in segment one, Bill Cassidy is a medical doctor and a new Republican member of the United States Senate from Louisiana. And he's offered a kind of compromise position about dismantling Obamacare. He said, well, if states like the Affordable Care Act, they should be able to keep it, and the states that don't want it should be able to gut it. Only problem is Obamacare relies on massive federal subsidies. And I don't think that Dr. Cassidy, by the way, my childhood pediatrician was Dr. Harry Cassidy. I don't think this Dr. Cassidy knows what he's talking about. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the PBC podcast. People like Cynthia Von Hendricks, Paul Tomaselli, Abby McMillan, and Wendy Gebauer. Thanks to each and every one of you. I invite others who never hear their name mentioned, and I haven't mentioned Paul Elsesser recently, pardon me. He is, by far, the leading supporter as a subscriber to the Peter B. Collins podcast. So if you haven't heard your name, it may be because you're not a subscriber. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and it only takes a couple of minutes to set up a PayPal order and buy the subscription you'd like. And if you're allergic to PayPal, we've got options. Just get in touch with me, peter@peterbcollins.com. The allegation that fake news was one of the components used by Russian intelligence to manipulate the American election has gained some traction in this country. And I don't believe it in any significant way. I'm sure that there were Russian operatives who were happily inserting false messages into social media and into the corporate media in this country. I don't deny that that's possible. But we have so many examples of Americans doing this. Americans who tried to flip the election in favor of Trump by using these Republican-enacted voter suppression tactics. Well, Scott Shane of the New York Times has been a guest on this program a couple of times. I respect him as a journalist. And I've criticized him recently because his byline has appeared on the misleading articles in the New York Times that stoke what I consider to be unproven allegations of Russian interference in our election. And we mentioned Scott Shane yesterday when we quoted the veteran intelligence professionals and their objections. That was a couple of days ago, I'm sorry. That in his article where he asserts what is assessed by the CIA and the FBI and the NSA, when you get to the inside jump of the story, you find that he acknowledges that there's no evidence for it. Well, today I praise Scott Shane because he used good old enterprise reporting. And he tracked down 23-year-old Cameron Harris, a recent college graduate who lives in Maryland. And he needed cash to pay down his student loans, so he started writing fake news. He paid $5 for the URL of a website that, represents a fake newspaper. It's called ChristianTimesNewspaper.com. Now, I'm one of at least 6 million people who saw his posts passed around on Facebook starting in October. And I actually reported it on the podcast. I said, this is bullshit. And the allegation published by the ChristianTimesNewspaper.com was that Hillary Clinton's people had stacked up boxes and boxes of ballots in Ohio. They're in a warehouse. And on Election Day, these boxes of ballots are going to be fed in with the real ballots, and that's how she was going to rig the election. So this guy Harris, tracked down by Scott Shane, appeared to be a little reluctant at first to admit what he had done. But after agreeing to tell the story, he described it as a very part-time gig. He made about $1,000 an hour in web advertising revenue, and he just sat down and made this stuff up. So in September, he said, well, gosh, who would have found these fraudulent Clinton ballots? So I think he may have been thinking of Joe the Plumber, but he came up with a guy named Randall Prince, totally fake, a Columbus area electrical worker. This everyman, a Trump supporter, that's how he was described, had entered a little used back room at the warehouse and stumbled upon stacked boxes of ballots pre-marked for Hillary Clinton. And then, because he thought it would be good to support his fake story with a photograph, he went online to Google Image, and he found ballot boxes from an election in Birmingham, England. And he used that picture, and there's a guy, a bald guy, standing next to a box of ballots, and he just, made this up. He wrote down, Mr. Prince, shown here, poses with his find as election officials investigate. So this was a very successful effort. Overall, the 6 million views, combined with other fake news that he wrote, earned him a total of $22,000. He estimates that $5,000 of that came from the Hillary ballot box fake story alone. And he said he needed the money for student loans, car payments, and rent. So my point here is that you don't have to go to Russia. You don't have to demonize Putin. You don't have to, believe these unproven accounts from our government that Russia manipulated the election. We had Americans actively doing it, and we haven't even mentioned the propaganda and disinformation operations run by the major political campaigns and their dark money super PACs. And tomorrow, I'm going to share my views on the Hillary or bust voters and the Democratic officials, including superdelegates, who made the bad bet on Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, the Democrats are wrangling over who will chair the Democratic National Committee, and last night, 7 candidates met in Washington, D.C. for a kind of a debate at George Washington University. And my favorite candidate is Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, the only Muslim who is in the House, and a real progressive, and a guy who is honest. I've interviewed him many times and gotten to know Keith a little bit, and I trust him. The other people running include Tom Perez, the outgoing Secretary of Labor from the Clinton, the Obama administration. He is the choice of the party establishment. And the Renegades are New Hampshire Party Chairman Ray Buckley. I got a Facebook ad from him yesterday, and I'd never heard of him. South Carolina Democratic Party Chairman Jaime Harrison, former Fox News analyst Jamu Green. Idaho Democratic Party executive Sally Boynton Brown, and the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, a gay veteran named Pete Buttigieg. Sorry about that. So we'll see how it all plays out. But there have been efforts to smear Keith Ellison, and we'll see if those are ultimately effective. Here in California, our senior senator, Dianne Feinstein, is in fact the most senior member of the United States Senate. She's currently 83. And she has dropped a big hint that she is planning to run for re-election in 2018. We need to get the message to Dianne that it's time for her to go. It's time for new faces in the Democratic Party. And I will always applaud Feinstein for fighting to get the torture report completed and released. But beyond that, she's been an apologist for the worst of the Washington errors of the last 15 years. And it's time for her to enjoy some time in retirement. Trump arrived in Washington today, and every move is being covered by the corporate media. I will not attempt to duplicate that. But the real whopper that he used, he went to his hotel and held a meeting. And before he kicked the press out, he said, "We have by far the highest IQ of any cabinet ever assembled." And then he praised his own intelligence. Donald, people who are smart don't have to do that. He has reiterated that he does plan to move the U.S. Embassy from Jerusalem, to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. There are issues because the Jerusalem building that the U.S. has isn't big enough for an embassy, but the Donald says he is still committed to that. George H.W. Bush and his wife, Barbara, have the best excuse for not attending the inauguration tomorrow. Poppy's in the hospital with pneumonia, and Barbara is also hospitalized with a cough, and they're trying to make sure, I guess, she doesn't get the pneumonia. They weren't planning to attend anyway, but I like the way I set that up. And Chuck Schumer is making it clear that despite all the noise, and there have been some great attacks on Republican nominees to the Wrecking Crew, that's Trump's cabinet, he is signaling that as early as Friday afternoon, following the inauguration, that the Secretary of Defense, Mad Dog Mattis, and the Director of Homeland Security, John Kelly, a general, will be confirmed by the Senate. They're described as non-controversial nominees. At this point, I do not see that the Democrats will succeed in blocking a single nominee of Donald Trump, and that does not bode well for the upcoming Supreme Court nomination battle. Rick Perry has decided that he was wrong when he said that he was going to shut down the Energy Department when he was running for president. That is, if he could remember the name of the department he was planning to shut down. He now says, now that he knows what the agency does, that he's really excited about running it. "The confirmation process has been extremely informative and beneficial for me," he said, because he didn't know what the Energy Department does. He thought he was going to be an international ambassador for the oil and gas industry. The Energy Department should be shut down, in my opinion, and its function should be merged into the Defense Department, where they belong. The bulk of the work of the Energy Department relates to our nuclear arsenal and not to domestic energy concerns of any kind. And by the way, Rick Perry has rethought his position on climate change and has one of those nuanced statements about how, yeah, it's real, but we just don't know to what extent. The real grilling has been reserved for Steven Mnuchin, the millionaire, perhaps billionaire, who's nominated for Trump secretary. He's an alumni of Goldman Sachs. He ran the foreclosure operation at One West, a troubled bank here in California, after the mortgage meltdown. And Steven Mnuchin forgot to report about $100 million of assets that he owns. You know, when you got that much, it's easy to, you know, $100 million here, $100 million there. And also, the chair of the confirmation hearing has prevented the victims of One West Mortgage from testifying against Mr. Mnuchin. So, Elizabeth Warren held a conference where she invited these people to offer their stories, and some of them are really harrowing and downright cruel. In addition, Mnuchin was held to account by members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate about offshore tax havens in the Cayman Islands. And Mnuchin says that he did advise clients at Goldman Sachs to use offshore tax dodges. But he said, I did not use a Cayman Islands in any way to avoid paying taxes for myself. And then he said that he would support any closure of the loopholes that allow his clients to continue to do that. Isn't that special? Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. You're free to share this far and wide with absolutely anyone. It's available on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until